Good evening, everyone. Am I listened to? Yeah, it's loud and clear. Thanks, everyone, for sharing this moment. I shall start the dialogue, I hope. The dialogue revolves around one single issue. The issue is, are we better off with cyberspace, with the internet? Are we not? Are we extending it the way we see fit, the way our dreams place the internet? I don't claim I have the answer. I'm here to help myself discover this answer in collaboration with people like you, developing and extending that technology. Is anyone here involved with the internet, extending it, developing applications? Are here any people not using the internet? It's clear, isn't it? Do you see this photo? Anyone recognizes this photo? There's this person, and he died. And he died physically, in mid-space, like shoot me right now and I die. And he was playing this game for quite a few hours every day. That's the game, Dark Age of Camelot. And when he died in mid-space, as we said, his players, the players who've been spending similarly enough time doing what the game involves, organized this funeral. And they held a funeral in which he stood in the shape of a heart. We can see clearly two people being at the center of the heart. That's his sister and his girlfriend. And they were allowed to dress themselves with an avatar so that they could participate in the funeral. Do any of you play video games online? Just two of you, you're lying then. It's the question, this is a world. Some people identify with the virtual universe of a video game as if it's their homeland. They say they've asked people, which world would you rather live in? And they identify that place saying EverQuest, Norrath, Camelot. Do you think this place is for free? Do you have the ability to extend this space in accordance with your own will, despite the preferences and the motivations of the companies behind it? What do you think? Any of that? That's the question I'm struggling with. If we migrate into cyberspace, like our kids have, then what should we expect for in 10 years' time? Will the entire life of ours become modified? In my own analysis, I see three forces. One is the digital condition. For me, the digital condition is about one thing, copy and paste. All the essence of being digital comes down to two words, copy, paste. On the other hand, we see all those devices, all those laws, all those forced regimes which build on one element, Do not copy, do not paste. Give us money. Where does it lead into? Will one force prevail over the other? At the same moment, lots of people say, we're hackers. We're programmers. We are free software developers who are doing what we like. We are outside the sphere of influence, of copyright, of, I don't know, of Sony, of EMI. Are we? This is the photo once again, and comes down to the question. Do you believe we've become cyborgs? It's a clear question, I think. Do you have a mobile phone? Who said no? You did. You have a mobile phone, Sven. What's the difference of having it in your pocket than inside your brain or your thigh? Do you have it always with you? Are you a cyborg then? Basically, from I've known you, so you come quite close to a cyborg. What about the others? Is anyone in this room not using a mobile phone? Quite a few, that's good. Why? I think you got the point across.
This one works. Okay, I have several reasons for not having a mobile phone. One part is I have too many friends that like to call me. So my home phone calls all the time. So when I'm here or on a trip, I don't like to be reached. So that's the main reason for me.
Thank you a lot. So basically what you're saying is you're switching it off. You're having a mobile, but you switch it off when you have a private moment.
No, I don't own a mobile. I have a normal traditional telephone and an answering machine. So they can leave messages, and when I come home and when I feel like it, I listen to those messages and return the calls, old style.
This is not irregular. Some people do not use a technology, or they break it. In the beginnings of the 19th century, Luddites in England got out of their houses every single night and they smashed what they identified as the beginning of their own end. Of course, as history is quick to point out, they were not very successful. But it is a fact that the whole British army was aroused and they actually had to send more troops to destroy and kill quite a few of those people. And the troops were more than the ones sent against Napoleon. Of course, different times. But there is the point in concern is some people break technology. Why do they do it? Are they effective? And if they are effective, to what social cost? How can we deal with technological development? There are quite a few presentations during this meeting about licensing. What is the law? The law is ethics. It reflects a given society's stand toward ethics in a given space and time. And we have laws or licensing mechanisms like the GNU-GPL, which ultimately what they seek to do is enforce ethics in the digital space. Where does it all leave us now? Is it sufficient trying to enforce ethics with the GNU-GPL or with any other license for that matter? or we should opt out of the legal framework of the legal space. They say that law will get worse, that tinkering with technology will become illegal. I don't know. Perhaps TechnoGPL will be found valid and perfectly legitimate as a licensing mechanism at courts. Maybe it won't. But is it enough? When the inventors of the GNU-GPL and most licenses conceived the need for a licensing device like the GNU-GPL, they thought of a world in which the concept of dynamic technology is non-existent. They thought of a world in which the developer can foretell with a certain degree of certainty how the technology will evolve with. It was clear, it was like developing the atomic bomb. You know, the atomic bomb will kill people. It cannot be used for good purposes. But say nowadays that you develop something and the US Army picks it up, says, this is a fine technology, I'll use this application which you have originally developed it for games, say, and they say we'll use it to navigate our missiles, our various military weapons, so that people somewhere die. What do? If you license it under the GNU-GPL, the same people will use it. The US Army will use it. In fact, I very much believe the US Army uses Linux. A couple of years ago, they asked Linus Torvalds about DRM and potential forced marriage between DRM, digital rights management, and Linux. And he says, I'm just an engineer. Do you know who said that phrase for the first time? I'm an engineer. Can you say it louder, a little bit? I don't know. Did he say it?
Well, I think it's Werner von Braun, because...
Oppenheimer.
Hmm?
I thought it was Oppenheimer.
I don't know.
I'm not saying that the other guy didn't say it as well. But from what I know of, the one who said it, who first said it, was
actually,
Oppenheimer.
Actually, there was only a wild guess from my side, because he was, well, just changing sides, and well, it's always difficult when you're in kind of extreme political systems, and you always have to, well, you have to justify for your past at least once.
This is another very disturbing photo. We all associate it in our minds with a single thing: destruction. I don't believe in any sort of nuclear desire, in any sort of nuclear threat materializing, becoming effective, destroying ourselves. However, I do believe that when we develop technology, or when we extend it or use it, it is the moment we make a clear choice. This person, John Hinton, involved in the development of the first atomic bomb, says at the Asian Countries Panel held in 1952 that he touched with his own hand the atomic bomb and that he did it because he believed in pure science. Then, when he saw the terror that the bomb his brainchild unleashed to the world, he said, that's bollocks. You cannot believe in pure science. What you develop, what you use, can and might be used against you or against somebody else. Three or four years ago, there was this very influential critique of technology by Bill Joy. Some of us I had this discussion yesterday about Bill Joy. That's why it struck me as relevant and pertinent now. And he says we should stop developing certain technologies, mostly focusing upon nanotechnology, robotics, and genetics. The reason he says so is because we cannot control how these technologies will evolve. And he says, relinquish, stop developing, stop researching. However, for two reasons, this is not feasible. Once upon a time, to make an atomic bomb, you needed either plutonium or plutonium and uranium and substances that one ordinarily cannot find at the supermarket. So you had to have access to highly top secret services and people who knew people, and so it goes. Whereas to make a weapon of mass destruction or of mass knowledge, as Joy said, one needs access only to knowledge. It's the same question like the ownership of the human genome, of DNA. Do you trust governments or profit-making enterprises? And even now that's in the public, that anyone of us has ownership, common ownership, of the public gene, of the human gene. Even then, can we control how some mad scientist, divorced from ethics, will put it to use? So the way I see it, and I'm not very smart, but I see only three responses. Either stop researching, stop developing, breaking technology, or believing in some fairness of the current system, believing that the system we live in will become a little bit more fair. And with the arrival of digital technology, some things, at least when we are online, will be possible. When you are online, you can copy and paste. Stop being online, then you cannot. But that is fair enough. This is fair use. Some property can be reproduced at no cost, some cannot. On the internet, you can be a radical. In real life, you cannot. At the same time, we have a few tendencies for projects that have started due to advances made possible in technology. And we see those tendencies, those examples, having an impact upon the real world. Grounds for hope, some say. This is what some people call a flash mob. It's an art project. Those people, without having any central leadership, they've still managed to gather at the same place, at the same time, as planned, in a decentralized manner, and do this installation. This is an art project. Art meaning having no social cost, being art. It's nice. Those people, which is a very lousy photo since it was taken from a mobile phone, is the first recorded flash mob. Those people have enacted a state of temporary paralysis in a bookstore. Perhaps flash mobs can be an art project, but at the same time, it's a riot. You see a mass, a mob, intruding some space. What does it mean? Perhaps in the very near future, flash mobs will be used to achieve political projects. In one book, I haven't seen it with my own eyes, there is a direct link drawn between flash mobs and the president of which country is it? I think it's in the Philippines, who got toppled after people got to the streets, protested hard, and it all was organized by nobody. Nobody organized it. People got really mad. They said, let's do it. And somehow, because of using their mobile phones and cyberspace, they did coordinate. They were not completely riot. Could flash mobs be used, or smart mobs, as some people say, to reflect the growing effectiveness and perhaps element of intelligence embedded in flash mobs? Can they be used to achieve or support political goals? One of the two, yes. To achieve any goal, you need two things. You need the ability to coordinate, to have concerted action without central person pulling the strings, and you also need some conditions, some circumstances. If people die because of starvation, they will revolt. If everyone is happy, they won't. So unless you have the condition, but you also need to have the ability to coordinate. This is a different level. This is technology. This is just a prototype. This is a computer which is not manufactured by anything that harms the environment. 100% recyclable. Manufactured while keeping in mind that people in places like Africa do not have the technological means to support a complex infrastructure. That thing had to be easy and simple. No screws used. The thing can be taken apart in 5 minutes, and you can put it back in another 5 minutes, even if you are a child. Is that project a political project or a technological project? This is Simputer. Simputer is a handheld device used much for the same geographical area where people do not know how to use the alphabet. They say that though there is much none proper landline phones in Africa, so the people have not access to landline equipment, they on the other hand have access to quite a few mobile phones, and given some time and the help of the African government, they will have a computer at hand. Other examples that come to mind: Dianbolic, Nopix. Mad London is another of my favorite applications. What is Mad London? Mad London is an application that it runs on Jabber. It's an instant messenger. People in London use it when they go free raving. They find a warehouse and they break in that warehouse around 10 o'clock in the evening. They send SMS or email to their friends and say, look, we're at this warehouse, it's free, come and join us. But sometimes the cops also get that email which says, come and join us. So they do, they join the party. The remaining people, though, are not very happy to see cops among them. God knows why. So there's this technology which allows you to annotate London with virtual post-it notes. From saying cops are on the way and syndicate that file via a friend of a friend-like technology, which means that I'm going to the party. I'm at the party, having a good time dancing. You come to the party and you see cops. You post a note saying, at this place, at this time, I tracked a police vehicle. The people I know that haven't yet arrived to the party, which means they are connected to me via a friend of a friend type of network, get that message as well, or they see it on Jabber. If a cop logs on to Jabber, doesn't see a thing. You can also, people in London, annotate the city with post-it notes regarding closed television cameras, places with a high criminal delinquency, and so forth. Mapping contemporary capitalism is another project and happens to be developed by the same woman who's the main developer behind Mad London. It's a mapping project. It's a mapping project which seeks to reveal hidden relationships, power flows among politicians, businessmen. How does it work? You have some information on some politician getting bribed. You go to the system, you enter that information and becomes available to everyone else. And via social network analysis tool, which is adapted to suit the purposes of this experiment, you help reveal connections among corporations. Or Forward Track. Forward Track is an application which maps the activists. How does it map them? First, if you allow the software to take notice of with whom you share emails, whom you send an instant message, what blogs you read, and on which blogs you leave comments, then you have it. Then you have a mapped social network which reveals which people you are affiliated to. And they contrast this social network with others. So if there are common ties, people showing up on both networks, then the system by itself automatically says you should meet this person. There are thousands, myriads of such projects. One problem is they do not interoperate. They're not compatible with each other. So they lack critical mass. They lack to have all people gathered in one place or to have them in different places, yet the system should be able to see them all. Is any of you working professionally on editing photos? You work professionally in photo editing. You're a photographer. Yeah, Mike.
Yeah, I do. I work with photos and video.
So you have access to Photoshop?
Well, no, I use Fireworks. I go with Macromedia. I used GIMP for 2 years, and it was all right when I was doing, you know, low-level stuff. But the things I couldn't do with GIMP that I can do with Fireworks, that, you know, I mean, Photoshop's overkill for the things that I would do. But I also, you know, I've had connections with the magazine industry and professional advertisements. And, you know, if you walk into a big company and you say, I don't want to use Photoshop, I want to use GIMP, you probably won't have a
job. So you think that GIMP is similar in scope with Photoshop, having much the same features, having much the same abilities?
Well, if you think so, I am.
No, I don't think so. I think that the GIMP is much more tuned towards children or easier applications than Photoshop.
GIMP is a wonderful tool, and it's a great alternative.
It is.
And if you run your own company and you can control, you know, what you're doing and why you're doing it, you know, as was the case for me for years, that was good. But GIMP doesn't do a lot of things that Photoshop does. I mean, there's a lot of external plugins and there's a lot of corporate procedures that people have in place. And, you know, there's business realities out there. Yeah, that doesn't make it right, but that makes it the case.
So you know how to use both Photoshop and the GIMP?
Yeah.
Where did you learn it, if I may ask? Did you learn it by yourself? Did you go to university to become educated in the use of Photoshop?
Well, no. I learned those programs the way that everyone else did. As a teenager, I pirated them and figured out how they worked. And, you know, and when I became an adult and had money, you know, then I either decided to use, you know, free software or, you know, pay for it. I don't pirate anymore much.
You know, I'm asking. 3 months ago, I met this kid. He's 14, and he says, I want to become a photographer. And somehow he managed to get a pirated version of Photoshop. However, that kid grows up in Greece, where pirate software is everywhere. In other places, a kid 14 years old cannot get a copy of Photoshop, cannot get a copy which contains that program.
Well, there's, you know, you can download a trial version, and then, you know, after the trial is over, you know, do what needs to be done to the system to reset the clock. And I mean, I don't think that children, that anyone who doesn't have the, in a capitalistic society, those who don't have the means of capital production or the means of attaining the medium of exchange, money, I don't think they should be held to the same standards that the people who do control the means of capital, you know, businesses and adults in the workforce and things like that. I think it's important to make that distinction. The corporations and the governments and the courts generally, you know, probably don't, but, you know, I'm not the guy who makes those decisions. You know, I just decide for myself personally.
I think you are exactly right and exactly to the point when you say, I used it, I go to learn it, and then when I started using it professionally, I knew I had the alternative between the GIMP, if it suited you, and between Photoshop, which you had to buy a proper license for, since you're using it professionally.
But at the same time, I think things are different now. It's like, you know, when I was much younger, you know, when I was 9, you couldn't pay $10 a month and get a Unix shell account. There wasn't free variants of the Unix operating system available. I mean, now anyone can run a Unix-like operating system on their computer if they want to. And now there are things like the GIMP out. So, you know, I really, you know, on the spot, I really don't know if my personal experience 20 years ago still applies with the situation now. I mean, I think ethically, it's a lot better to grow up in a situation where you just say, you know, fuck Photoshop, I'm going to learn GIMP. And then, you know, if things change and if you do acquire the skills of capital production and, you know, can enter that arena. I mean, it's, you know, there's a lot of, it, you know, it's complicated. It's, you know, it's not, you know, there's a lot of, I mean, on the one hand, you know, if no one buys Photoshop, does more Photoshop get made? You know, I'm a Mac user. Mac users right now are like, what, 1% of the market? If you don't buy Mac software and you like it, then, you know, you don't get any more. I mean, unless it's, you know, free software that people do it because they feel a need to do it for themselves or love. Or and I've been holding this microphone way too long. I'm getting kind of uncomfortable, so I'm going to pass it off to someone else.
Thing is, I agree with you on all grounds, on all things. The only thing I have a slight tendency to overlook is that some people use something professionally and some people do not use it professionally. If you use your Mac to write music, say you are a DJ and you want to produce some music, and then you buy Logic and you give, I don't know, 1,500 euros for version or similar kind of money for other software, what you do when you do it professionally is not what I'm interested in. And there are other people who want to do it to get the knowledge, people who do not have the financial means to attend the university course, some people who would like to teach themselves photography, and all they can afford with is the initial cost of the hardware, which when it comes to a PC is quite low. You can put together a PC using very cheap and affordable solutions. And that's exactly what I hope for, that more people will not give that money to buy Photoshop. They will either use GIMP so that GIMP becomes equally strong, equally helpful, equal in size, in community, in features as Photoshop. It's a twisted logic, but it grows. I mean, lots of software has grown in size over the 5 or 6 or 10 years. If I take that for a spin, what I'm really saying is that we shouldn't tell users use Linux because it's licensed under the GNU/GPL. And to whom do you say use Linux because it's under the GNU/GPL? Do you say that to graduates, to university students who can afford having a nice life and buying software? What do you tell that to someone who looks how to squeeze some money out of his own pension to start a new business? or to someone who wants to study computers but cannot afford a university course. And I see this thing, this tendency, in various fields, in various areas of connectivity. I see it in Linux, but I also see it in Wi-Fi networks. Why people use Wi-Fi? Because it's free. I mean, I use it because it's free. Does it make it good because it's free? Not necessarily, but in many respects, yes, it's good. What is a Wi-Fi network? My computer interacting with another, sharing files. Our files, it's my files in my computer. If you want to have it, you can have it. And that's it, in a few words. I would like to leave 5 minutes for questions, for discussion, even between you people. So, here goes. Hit me. Otherwise, go have a beer. It's very nice. Or grab me by the arm outside. Tell me, this is bollocks, you're saying. Thank you all for coming anyway. It's been a real pleasure being here with you. Even if you dislike my presentation, it's good to be here.